from Janilia Farms and is doing his postdoc with Mitya Chklovsky. And by training, he's a physicist, but he also studied humanities and even a semester arts in Italy. So we expect very nice slide design. And, and after that, he did a PhD with Idan Zegev, and now he's working on stability out of volatility. Please.
Can you hear me like this? Sort of? Yeah? Okay, so I'm Shaul Druckmann. I want to thank the organizers for inviting me. I'm very excited to share my work, our work with you. So the title is Stability Out of Volatility, and this study was inspired by this amazing phenomenon of working memory, whereby animals turn a transient stimulus into a persistent representation. So the classical example is a delayed match to sample task. So a monkey sits in a chair, he stares at a fixation point. At a certain time, an image is going to be briefly flashed on. That was it. Then there's going to be a delay period of several seconds between a few seconds and tens of seconds, and then a second image is flashed on. And the monkey's task is to say whether they're same or different. So the first image was the image of the Janela Farm research building. The second image was that of the Eiffel Tower. So there are two different images. If the monkey is smart, he'll say they're different. If the monkey is really smart, he'll say that apparently they're the same length if put end to end and equally popular as tourist attractions. So how does this actually work in the end? So let's imagine there's a hypothetical neuron, and I'm going to plot its firing rate as a function of time. And of course, two critical times are the time of the first image presentation and the second image presentation. And let's assume this neuron codes for the image or some part of the image. So if there would be a firing rate that looks like this, right, once we present the image, the neuron codes for it, so its firing rate goes up, and then it remains steady and elevated during the entire delay period, then this would explain exactly how these things work. Right, we still have to worry about what's the biophysics that allows this, but conceptually, the explanation is very simple. Persistent activity supports a persistent network representation. And amazingly enough, there are actually neurons like this. They were found in the early 70s in the prefrontal cortex. But unfortunately, the story is a little bit more complex. So when more careful experiments were done later on, it turns out that these kind of neurons are extremely rare. So they make up between 5 and 10% of this population in numerous studies. And most importantly, this is idea mainly from Arnulfo Rumo's lab, that the real activity is actually much more complex, much more time-varying. So these are just four example neurons. And what you see here is that the firing rate of the first guy goes up, then starts going down. Of this guy, it goes down and then starts going up. This one does something weird in between. This one only remembers that it's supposed to be on at the end. And it's a lot of things, but it's not this simple picture, which we can conceptually understand. So this raises a question. Oops. How did I do that? I'm not sure. Okay. Wrong button. Okay. This raises a question. Can the complex, time-varying neuronal activity that we know is in there underlie the persistent stimulus representation that we know there has to be in order for the monkey to succeed in the working memory task? Okay, and the traditional answer is no. And why is that the case? So neuron codes code for things with their firing rate. If the firing rate changes, what they code for changes, and the stimulus representation changes. Okay, so that's the traditional answer. And I'm going to talk mainly in the context of working memory, but this is actually a much more general question. So neural activity varies on a very fast time scale, but the world doesn't. The world typically varies much slowly. So if we see all these changes of activity when we're recording, does it mean that every time that we see a change of activity, there's a change in representation? That's something that we need to think about, and I'll go back to the context of working memory, and we'll go back to that at the end. Okay, so I'm going to give a simple example to explain the intuition. Please bear with me, even though it seems very simplistic. So let's imagine we want to represent points on a plane. Stimulus dimension is 2. And we're going to choose to represent it with 2 neurons. So this is going to be the receptive field or feature vector of the first neuron, this direction in the plane. This is going to be the receptive field or feature vector of the second neuron, that direction in the plane. And now we want to represent this point in space. So how am I going to do it? It's pretty easy. So let's take half times the activity of neuron 1. So I scale down this vector, move it here. And let's take 1 times the activity of neuron 2. So I take this vector unscaled, add it tip to toe like vectors, and I represent this point. Okay? So now what happens if we change the activity? So say 1 times neuron 1 and half times neuron 2, then of course this represents a different point in the plane. Okay, so this is just to reinforce this point. So at this point, we might start to question our idea of doing sort of this simple linear encoding and might think that we do something nonlinear. But actually, there's a second assumption here that's a bit more implicit that we need to think about, and that's that the stimulus dimensionality is equal to the number of neurons. And why might we want to think about this? So in general, divergent architectures are very, very common in the brain. So specifically, the classical example is the thalamocortical projection. So there's a huge amount of cortex neurons when you compare it to the number of thalamical neurons. So this ratio can be 20, 30, 40 times in primates and humans. And that means that the number of neurons is vastly greater than the dimensionality of the stimulus if we use this assumption that what the cortex is encoding for are things coming out of thalamus, which is simplistic, but there's a ratio of 20 to 40. So how does this change things? Okay, so let's go back to the same example, stimulus dimensionality 2. Let's pick a number that's 20 to 30 times bigger than 2, say 3, so that I can still plot it. And let's pick an arrangement of receptive fields. This is the arrangement that, believe it or not, is called the Mercedes-Benz frame. But it could be called the peace sign frame, or I could have done 4 and did the BMW frame, which might have been more appropriate for Munich. But we'll leave it at that. And let's look at the same question. Okay, so we want to represent this point in space. And how am I going to do it? Well, there's one very easy way. Let's just take 1 times neuron 1. That's fine. But there are also other ways. So for instance, I can take half times neuron 1 minus half times neuron 3. So I scale it and flip it, minus half times neuron 2. Add them up tip to toe, and I get exactly the same point. And of course, there are not just two ways. There are an infinite number of ways. So if you look at the top, these are the same bar plots that represent the activity of these three neurons. And cyan is, again, the point that's being represented. And you see that these different patterns of activity represent in different ways exactly the same point. So, of course, I can't just... it's not that I can only represent this point in space, that we are a really weird network. Other patterns of activity will cause a different point to be represented. Okay, so this type of phenomenon can only happen when the number of neurons is greater than the dimension of the stimulus. So how do we understand this? So the easiest way to understand this is to think of activity space. So activity space is a way to visualize and understand network dynamics. So the activity of a network at a given time point is a point in a space of dimensionality equal to the number of neurons. So in this case, 3. And a necessary consequence of the fact that there are more neurons than stimulus dimensions is that there's a degree of freedom over which the network dynamics can change, but there will be no change in representation at all. And the animation before was just the sort of the network state going up and down this line. So how does this help us? So when we record from a single neuron, what we're doing is we're looking at a single projection of the space onto a single dimension. So for instance, if we now look at the projection on neuron 1, which is this direction in space, and the network does the same thing, then what we see, the firing rate goes down, and then it goes up. And all the while, the representation is exactly the same. And this can look like one of Romo's neurons. Of course, for any other neuron, I could have found an equally sort of a different dynamics that would give you that shape. So the most important point here is that this complex time-varying activity is completely consistent with static or time-invariant network representations. So not every time that you see activity changing, that means that something is being coded for differently. Okay, so there's one small caveat. So before, I'm using PowerPoint to make the point go up and down, which is slightly hard, but much less. But for the brain, it's actually much harder because it needs to keep the dynamics on this plane physically, right? Not in PowerPoint. And one specific problem is that if there's no stimulus, and it's a reasonable assumption that if you turn off the image, there's no stimulus, activity is going to decay down to 0. But more generally, how does the network know to stay on this line? So the other very salient feature of cortex is that neurons not only have a divergent architecture, they have strong lateral connections, and these are going to do the job. And I want to go through the math of how they do the job. Okay, but first we need to establish a little bit of nomenclature. Okay, so we're going to talk about linear coding. So again, our stimulus, which is some image, is simply the weighted sum. This is each one of the neurons. It has a receptive field. There are a lot of them. Receptive field just looks like a different image, and we weight them by their activity. Okay, so now math. We're going to turn each one of these guys into a one-dimensional stimulus vector S. So in the case of images, simply take the grayscale. Okay, we're going to turn each one of these feature vectors or receptive field into a vector of its own. We're going to concatenate them into a presentation matrix D, and the summing and weighting is simply a multiplication by the activity vector A, where the point in the vector is simply the coordinate of the neuron. So the equation we get is S equals dA. Does that make sense? Good. OK, so now we're ready to solve the problem. So we're working in linear encoding, S equals dA. I hope things won't get chopped off. And we're interested in very simple dynamics, because that's how we generally work. We want to use the simplest assumptions first. So this equation, A dot, which represents the derivative of A with respect to time, is equal to, let's just look at the first term, minus A. This means that in the absence of stimulus or anything else, if we didn't have the second term, activity would decay to zero. L is a matrix, which presents lateral connectivity, hence the L. And this is the usual way you do it in rate dynamics, that you get the input to the rate by multiplying a matrix L, which represents synaptic connectivity, by the dynamics at a given time point. Okay, so this is the standard way to go about it. What we're interested in is the derivative of S with respect to time, whether the stimulus changes or not. So we just plug that in, dA dot, and we want it to be zero. We want the stimulus to be persistent. Okay, so let's plug in our equations. So we plug in this here, simplify a little bit, and we get this expression dA equals dLA. We want this expression to hold for all A. There are no special patterns of activity A for which this works and those that don't. So we can simplify and get d equals dl. D equals dl is a family of solutions, family of equations that represent the type of lateral connectivity L that you need in order to get the representation to be persistent. So for instance, there's the trivial solution L equals I, which is just each neuron connects only to itself, only has an autops, but we're not going to be interested in this solution because it's not cortex and it's not a real network anyhow. Okay. So it turns out that in addition to this equation, there's actually a really nice intuition behind it, and it's that what you want to have is that the sum of the outgoing synapses times the postsynaptic receptive field will be equal to the neuron's own receptive field. So let's see how that plays out. So we have our favorite Mercedes-Benz frame, and we solve for the network, and we get this very artificial network, which is not surprising because this is an artificial toy example. So each neuron is connected to every other neuron with an equal strength inhibitory connection. And let's see how this rule plays out. So we have the receptive field of the first neuron. That's the up direction in space. We have the neuron's connections, minus 1 times A2. So we take A2, we flip its direction, and then minus 1 times A3. We take A3, we flip its direction, we add them up like vectors, head to toe, and you would get exactly the same thing. So if you stop to think about it one second, then neurons have two ways to generate representation. They have their own receptive field and their own activity, and that's one way they can represent. But they also have these lateral connections that cause other neurons to change their activity and cause these other neurons to change their representation. And in this particular case, these things line up. Okay, so let me... Oh, sorry, and we call this principle refire for... because we need to have, a short name for receptive field recombination. Okay, so let me quickly recap. In an orthogonal representation, and in case there are mathematicians in the room, I should be using the term injective representation and non-injective, but I'm going to stick with orthogonal to be more human. In an orthogonal representation, any change in activity will cause a change in representation. This is our usual intuition. In a non-orthogonal representation, some changes in activity will not cause a change in representation. Representation loss to neuronal leakiness or any other dynamics can be compensated by eliciting activity in other neurons through lateral connections. And our formalism simply describes how to construct this connectivity. Okay, so let's actually do that. Let's construct connectivity for not toy examples. These are the receptive fields of a bunch of neurons. At this point, we've made different assumptions, but at this point, the receptive field is just random in some hypothetical space, so it's just these random points. And we have to pick a single solution out of this family of solutions. And here we look again at the cortex. We know that cortical connectivity is sparse, so neurons connect only to a few other neurons in cortex and not to every other neuron. So what we do is we simply apply this rule to a sparse set of neurons. So we take a neuron, we look at its receptive field, and we try to find a sparse sum over feature vectors that gives you the same receptive field. In this case, these are these guys, and you go on and on, neuron after neuron, until you get the network. So what do you do with the network? The first thing to do is to just numerically validate that our math was right. So this is the activity of these neurons, just simulated in a simple way. It's time varying. This is the representation of the network. This image is representing at 0, at 10 neuronal time constants, 20 neuronal time constants, 30 neuronal time constants, and so on. It will remain exactly the same. The second thing is to look at it. Oh, sorry. You can show this a second way. So in red, I'm going to plot the activity of 6 neurons, and I'm going to plot their contribution to the network representation. So the network representation is a 2D image. I'm only going to plot the first column so I can plot it with time. So it's going to look something like this. So let's look at a neuron. So let's say neuron 3. So its activity changes with time, which causes its representation to change with time. But the network representation as a whole remains exactly the same all throughout this thing because of this recombination of receptive fields. OK, so now we want to look at the structure of the network. So we can use one of these really fancy algorithms from graph theory to give you some sort of image of what the network looks like. And if it's late enough at night and you're doing it for a long time, you can imagine you see pinwheels here and all kinds of things. But frankly, this is completely useless because we can't compare it to biology. Okay, so, and I also wanted to wake people up in case. Okay, so what can we do? So what we can do is look at lower order correlations that have actually been measured. Okay, so the simplest thing is to just look at synaptic weights, and you can get the real synaptic weights by paired patching experiments, or more than pairs. And what people typically find is that there is this long tail, which is sort of unexpected. And in our network, we get the same type of thing. In our case, it's a little bit more expected because when you pick sparse sums of objects, you tend to get long tails. So we wanted to look at higher order properties like motifs. So what is a motif? We can look at two neuron motifs first. So we have a neuron and a second neuron. So neuron A can connect to neuron B with a certain probability, and neuron B can connect to neuron A with the same probability. And now we ask about reciprocal connections. So neuron A is connected to neuron B, and neuron B is connected to neuron A. And we ask, what's the probability that this happens? So both in our networks and in cortical networks, this probability of reciprocal connections is higher than chance. Okay? And the intuition behind it is that if you're trying to find neurons that are going to add up to your own receptive field, and you want to do it in a sparse way, then the first thing to do is to pick the guy who's closest to you. But if you're closest to a certain guy, then it's also reasonable that he is also the closest receptive field to you. Reasonable, but not necessary. And that's why you tend to get these preferred connections. We can carry on doing this for three neuron motifs, which you can still measure in the cortex. And we again get this picture of that these highly connected reciprocal motifs are overexpressed. And finally, if we want to be a bit daring, then in principle, you could actually check the refire rule. So what you would have to do is these really crazy experiments that Moritz has been describing. So what you want to do is you want to map the receptive fields of neurons. Then you want to go into EM, scan by EM, and start reconstructing. And our prediction would be is that if you go down the axon of this neuron, you look at the first neuron it connects to, look at its receptive field, you collect this receptive field, remember it, and then go to the second neuron, find a connection, take its receptive field, collect it, and so on. You add these guys up, you should eventually end up with the own receptive field. So this is practically impossible, but, you know, so I would have thought so as having a 900 by 900 matrix of the retina, so who knows? Maybe someone will be able to do it. Okay. So at this point, it might sound like a really weird rule, and I'm talking about neurons finding other neurons and adding up, and how could this actually ever happen biologically? So it turns out that for special networks that have a certain symmetry property to their organization, which mathematically is called a tight frame, and a good example of this is you take, again in the plane, you take a receptive field and you change it each time by a certain degree. So for these type of networks, then a Hebbian learn will give you a refire network. Not only that, it will give you a special kind of connectivity in which the connectivity matrix is a shifted, each row is a shifted version of the other, which is known as a Teplitz matrix, and then you can do some analytical work on the eigenvalues, which you can ask me about later. Okay. Another thing that we want to show is that you can actually extend this to nonlinear networks, and we can extend this to certain kinds of nonlinear networks, like ideal integrated fire neurons. And again, this is the same idea of neuron activity changing, this time spiking, representation changing, but in the network as a whole remaining the same. So I want to move on to another actually beautiful idea that was also due to Ranulfo Romo, and that's the idea of hierarchy of persistence. And this elegant notion is that what you have in cortical areas, as you ascend the cortical hierarchy, so of S1, S2, and forward, then also the persistence of stimuli becomes greater. So you're going to have very short persistency, tens or hundreds of milliseconds, even in primary sensory areas. And this has been shown in V1. It's going to be longer, say, half a second or a second in secondary sensory areas until it's the full thing in the prefrontal cortex. And it turns out that you can do this very similarly in a refire network. So you generalize a little bit the rule from d equals dl to alpha d equals dl, and you get the same thing, that as you change alpha, you can get the full scale of persistency from the single neural time constant to infinity. And in these cases, activity does decay. It's still time varying, and the representation decays. And the reason this is actually important is because you can use the much more detailed reconstructions of early sensory cortices and the much more reasonable estimation of receptive fields to make some predictions which turn out to be true. So for instance, we can look at these receptive V1-like receptive fields. Each one has an angle. We can look at the angle between them, and we can ask what's the probability of a connection given a certain angle. And when we do this, what we find, the red ones are between connected neurons, is that you're more likely to make a connection with someone who has a similar angle to you than with someone who isn't. And the blue is just when you do this over unconnected neurons to show that there's no bias in the distribution and angles that would have caused this. And you find the same thing by a way similar to what Moshe described. So you take a neuron, you see where it was in terms of the orientation, then you track its axon and see where these little clusters end up, and you can get these plots which are similar, or in work that was done much more recently, which actually physically measured receptive fields by calcium imaging, and then went into the same slice and measured connectivity, you get the same thing. So this agrees very well with that. Okay, so in the last few minutes, I want to move from stuff I know is true to what I actually don't know, but want to share with you anyhow. So the big thing that I don't know, and I think a big thing that many people don't know, is why have this divergent architecture? Why have this overcompleteness? Or overcompleteness, what is it good for? And I don't believe that it's absolutely nothing, so let's give one simple example. And the simple example has to do with how can you represent a stimulus. So in a regular representation, an orthogonal representation, there's only one way to represent each stimulus. So if we look at this in activity space, then this is one stimulus and some cloud of noise around it, and this is the only way to represent it. If we look at a second stimulus, this is this stimulus and a cloud of noise around it, there's only one way to represent this stimulus too. The issue is that we can make the animal have sort of any arbitrary association between these two stimuli. So it could be nice if these stimuli were told that one could tell them apart. In an orthogonal representation, you're stuck with only one way to encode this. In a non-orthogonal representation, you can use this degree of freedom to push them apart. And in fact, again, if you stand back and think of it, in an orthogonal representation, there's only one way to represent each stimulus. So if you believe that you need to change network activity in order to do some computation, then you can't do any computation internally within a network. The only thing you can do is you can push it to a feedforward network to the next one and next one and next one. So this is sort of not appreciated until you actually stop for a second and think of it, because we're so used to looking at these things that we don't think about it. Okay, so now I'm completely into the realm of things I don't know, but I'm going to tell you.